I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in on Alaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Nome is probably best known to the world as the finish line of the Iditarod, but in reality, it's so much more. A crossroads of Arctic survival, gold rush mayhem, and deep indigenous history. Today on Outdoor Explorer, our guest is writer, anthropologist, and wilderness guide Michael Engelhard. Michael's writing is shaped by both lived experience and cultural insight after 25 years of guiding and exploring in Alaska and beyond. In his newest book, No Place Like Nome, Michael explores the people, histories, and the absurdities that make Nome truly unique. Keep listening for more on Outdoor Explorer as one man's path from river guide to writer opens a window into Nome, the Arctic, and the stories that connect us all. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. I'm talking to author Michael Engelhard about his book, No Place Like Nome. Michael Engelhard is an anthropologist, essayist, and wilderness guide whose writing bridges lived experiences with cultural history. He spent 25 years working as a wilderness guide and outdoor instructor in Alaska and the Colorado Plateau. He's written several books, including the National Outdoor Book Award-winning memoir, Arctic Traverse, and his writing has appeared in publications such as Outside, Backpacker, Audubon, and Alaska Magazine. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer, Michael.
Yeah, hi, Martha. Good to be here.
Thank you. You've been a guest before, so thanks for coming back. So, let's just dive right into who you are and what we're here to talk about. So you've got a really interesting mix of experiences. You're a wilderness guide. You've studied anthropology. You've written books and essays. Tell us a little bit about that, how that mix of experiences came to be.
Well, I always wanted to live up north ever since I was a teenager. Probably read too much Jack London at a susceptible age. And eventually, I traveled the United States by hitchhiking in 1982, and had some pretty incredible experiences. Among others, I got taken in by a Hopi family on Sacred Mesa and lived with them for a while. And then I ended up on the Yucatan and went to this island off the coast of Yucatan in Mexico that was unpopulated. There were just a biologist research station there and some Mexican fishermen, and they took me in. I stayed there for a while. So long story short, it revitalized my interest in different cultures, and I started to attend classes at the University of Munich for anthropology, and knew that I wanted to do an exchange, an academic exchange at some point, and go north and experience these, because I really was entranced by the native cultures of the far north. And so after a year in Munich, I did get a scholarship, actually, to go to Edmonton, Alberta. And I had been there before in Canada, visited, and it's a big city. It's kind of cowboy, a lot of oil money, and it's a long ways from the mountain. So I had my doubts about it. And then one day I saw a photograph of campus, of UAF campus, taken up from the West Ridge where the Geophysical Institute is. And you may know or not that on a clear day from up there, you can see Denali actually on the horizon. And I said, wow, I'm going there. Screw Edmonton. And a lot of my friends thought they were kind of crazy. I was kind of crazy because I had scholarship for Canada, but there wasn't a scholarship to go to Alaska, attend university. And I said, you know what, I'll make it happen somehow. And I did go. And originally I was only supposed to be there for a year as an exchange student, but I really liked the program, and they kind of liked me. And so they got me a teaching assistantship and a research assistantship. And I ended up staying there and getting my master's degree. And even my first summer, I had some incredible experiences. I went out with some Inupiaq people where we're doing a multi-year land use and subsistence study for the Park Service in the Gates of the Arctic and Kobuk River National Parks. Because as you may know, if the native people can't demonstrate that they have historically and contemporarily use those areas. They're still entitled to go there and pursue subsistence activities. So we did some research related to that. And I got to go out with this woman and a relative of hers. She was living in Cayena, Martha Wells. And I got to go to Onion Portage for a caribou hunt. They were hunting caribou there. And that's a really powerful place. They've done excavations there, archaeological excavations. People have been hunting caribous there at least for 11,000 years. So I just couldn't believe I was doing these incredible things and getting paid for it too, you know. So I ended up getting my master's degree at UAF and then embarked on a PhD. Ended up teaching some summer courses up there in Native Cultures of Alaska class. But I realized that the deeper I got into the academic scene, the less excited I felt about it. I realized I wasn't the best classroom teacher. And if I think back, it's not where I've learned the important life lessons. It was in the outdoors, not in the classroom. And also, I kind of was a little bit influenced by Richard Nelson, who has been a role model of mine for a long time. I never met him personally, but started out, I read his book, his studies that he'd done with the Koyukon Athabascans, and watched the Make Pairs to the Raven series of videos. And as you know, Richard dropped out of academia too, because he always said, you know, I'm passing myself off as the expert here, and I'm not really the expert. I'm the naive child in the woods. And these people, these native elders, they're the experts really. They're the ones that taught me everything I knew. And so I kind of felt similarly, because here I was, a white guy from, not even from the US, and I'm standing in front of classes, the summer session classes, that had native students in them, and I tell them about their own culture. So it was super weird, you know?
Yeah.
And then in addition, I couldn't get any funding for my field work. I'm a lousy grant writer. I shouldn't even admit that as a writer, but it's the kind of writing I'm not really excited about. I was trying to get some monies to do a year's worth of field work in Arctic Village with the Gutchin there. And when that didn't come through, I said, you know what? I don't need a PhD. To me, it doesn't make a difference, because what can I do with it? I can go teach in the university system, which I would already realize is not my cup of tea. Or, you know, I could work for the oil companies or the Park Service, and I don't work well in organizations like that. So I dropped out and was looking for jobs. And the only job that, well, I wanted to be outdoors. I knew that, and was lucky enough to log into a training guide position out of Chicoloon on the Matanuska River. So I became a river guide there, and basically I was sold ever after on the outdoors life, and tried to make a living between guiding with a strong educational component. I've always worked for programs like Wild Rockies Field Institute and Outward Bound, both in Alaska and in the Colorado Plateau. And even on the commercial trips I guide, it's always been important to me that people learn something about the places that we travel in for various reasons. For one thing, it deepens their experience of the place, but also the hope is that eventually when these places are threatened by development, that they might actually stand up for them and write to their congressperson or whatnot, or get involved. And, you know, I don't have to tell you, especially right now with everything being dismantled, that's more important than ever.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of already touched on this a little bit, but how does your background in anthropology influence the way that you incorporate indigenous knowledge and perspectives into your work?
It's just crazy. The landscape up there, especially up in the Arctic, looks so vast, open and empty and unpeopled. And yet, through the work that I've done with the Park Service and talking to these elders, I did some interviewing where I went with a set of maps to their house, and these old timers showed me where they all had been in their lifetime and what they've been doing in those places. And I always, those maps, I look at them sometimes still, and they remind me of Jackson Pollock paintings, you know? It's just every place up there, except maybe for the mountaintops, where only white people climb mountaintops because there's really nothing, there's no food or anything to be had. But every other place really has been traveled, and many of them have been named, and many of them also have stories tied to them. So this whole idea that any place is wilderness in North America is erroneous, since, you know, but since at least 13,000 years ago, when people first crossed the Beringia and came into this new world, there hasn't really been any wilderness. If your concept of wilderness implies that it's the absence of people. And I'd like to try to get that across, that we go out there as wilderness travelers and we call it adventuring, but to them it's just going out and get food for the fridge. And for generations of people have called it home, you know, and to us it's this unforbidden, empty, unstoried place, and it's nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah. So your most recent book, which is coming by the time this show airs, it will be recently available everywhere, I believe. No Place Like Nome. How did you end up in Nome, and what drew you to write a book about it?
How did I end up in Nome? Well, through my wife, because she's the actual breadwinner. She has a career that makes money. Okay. And like you, she's in the medical field. Now we moved, but she used to be a public health nurse for the state of Alaska. And in the course of her career, we've been living not just in Fairbanks, but also in Cordova. And then this position in Nome opened, which for one thing, it paid really well, but it also sounded like a really interesting place to live. And since I already knew the area a little bit from my guiding, had come through there in Kotzebue and from my anthropological work, I said, let's move there. And so we lived there for several years, from like 2011 to 2014, I believe. And she got to do also some very incredible stuff. She flew out to some of the islands, the communities out there in the Bering Strait on the islands. That was part of her beat. So she got to go out to St. Lawrence Island and even to Little Diomede, which is right on the international dateline. And I was still guiding, which was a bit of pain in the neck because I was guiding the Brooks Range. And in order to get to my trip, my outfitter was in Fairbanks. I had to fly from Nome to Anchorage to Fairbanks and then back up north, you know. But I also was doing my Arctic Traverse at that point when we lived in Nome, starting at the Bering Strait and hiking all the way and floating to Kotzebue. And it almost felt, because Kotzebue is not too far from Nome, it's just a 20-minute air flight. And so to me, it almost felt like walking home. You know, I started on the Canadian border. I said, well, I'm walking home now. And that added a really powerful emotional component to that journey. I think I didn't answer your question really, but.
Oh yeah, I was just curious. I was just curious about how, what influenced you to write about Nome, you know, as of all the places that you've been and all of the things that you've done, what drew you to write a book about Nome?
You cannot live there and not write about Nome if you're a writer. You know, I use the image of, it's like a set of Russian dolls where one story nests within another story. But I think the better metaphor is actually a chain where every link hangs on another. And so all these stories, they bear new stories, and you can go as deep as you like, you know. And the characters that have lived in Nome in the past historically and also still today, it's just a unique place that shapes and or attracts a certain kind of personality. And it sits biologically and geographically, it's a borderland, you know. It culturally and biologically, it definitely feels like the Arctic, even though it's about the same latitude as Fairbanks. So technically it qualifies as the subarctic, but with the Inupiaq culture being that strong, you know, you get once in a blue moon, you get polar bears there, and we have muskoxen right in town in Nome. It definitely feels like the Arctic. And it's a smallish community, but everything is humanly portioned, human-sized. You know, you can walk everywhere in town, and there's some highways where you can explore the surrounding areas, but it still has that totally cut off from the road feeling. Actually, any kind of truck or larger construction equipment has to be brought in by barge, which is used to be only possible in the summer. And so the rest of the year, you know, you can fly in, but that's about it.
So this book is organized a little bit more like a collection of essays versus in like a chronological order, which is different from a lot of ways that people talk about history. What made you resist that a linear timeline, and how does that sort of mirror the way Indigenous cultures see their own history?
For one thing, the linear chronology is kind of boring, and there's large stretches of history that didn't interest me that have already been done. You know, like the Gold Rush, for example, which I still touch upon. I mean, it's just such a crazy chapter in Nome's history. You can't, you can't just skip it. But by training and by inclination, I am an essayist. So I love the form because it allows me to meander and, you know, I never know when I start writing an essay where I'm going to end up. Whereas if I write a book chronologically, like the Arctic Traverse, I always knew it was going to start at the Canadian border and end at the Bering Strait. But there's also an origin story that kind of explains why the book is arranged in four segments of essays. And that's because over the years, I've written a lot of essays about Nome and the Bering Strait for Alaska Magazine. And so those ended up forming the core for this, because I ended up getting to a point where I had so much material Nome related and Bering Strait related. I said, you know what? It would make a really, really nice book, because believe it or not, there isn't really a book about Nome. There's some photo books and stuff, but there isn't really a book that focuses on that sort of history that I was interested in. And the circular thing or the meandering thing, that's sort of like a forager being out on the land. You know, you check here. It's not like they're saying, oh, I'm going to go there and I'm going to get this. I mean, that might be the underlying intention, but along the way, you leave. People might just go out of their way to visit the place where they used to have a fish camp, or where they were born when they were still living on the land, and or just to teach information about the land and certain places and the stories that come with them to their children and to their families. And so I like that sort of approach to storytelling too.
You so anthropology is a lot of times about like observation of others. How do you balance this idea of being an observer and a participant while also telling the story, kind of melding those two things together?
Well, the paradigm in cultural anthropology is actually participant observation. So you're not just the observer, you're also in there doing things. And because that's still one of the best ways of learning. And in a lot of native cultures, you do learn by observing and also by just being asked to do certain things and you figure them out, rather than by formal instruction as we Westerners know it, and certainly not reading about them. So I always like that component about, and it makes you really feel like a beginner again. It's easy to step back as a writer and as an anthropologist and to be the critic and see everything through a removed lens, but it's a lot harder when you're actually being put in there and forced to do things. You know, like when I went out with the couple of elders there hunting it on your portage, I was expected to help with the caribou because, you know, skinning and butchering it, because that's a lot of work. And I've always, you know, had a strong practical side. On my guided trips, sometimes rather than explaining how something's done, you know, I tend to jump in and get it done, you know? So I think it's a perfect combination between the participation and the observation.
In your, in the introduction to your book, you talk about how most histories of Nome start in 1898, but you make it very clear that the history of Nome actually stretches back thousands of years, 10,000 plus years. And you acknowledge the limits of writing a history as an outsider to the culture. What challenges did you face in writing about a place whose indigenous history tends to be ignored? And how did you bring those indigenous voices into the narrative?
The sources are kind of skimpy oftentimes, you know, and even with native peoples, a lot of the knowledge has been lost and is not currently handed down anymore. So in order to retrieve some of that information, you actually have to go back to historical sources, which unfortunately oftentimes were the explorers and the anthropologists. So, you know, wherever possible, I tried to incorporate native voices, and there's a lot of recordings and such, and images. Visual sources were a real good source of information, because the image can be manipulated, but really in those days, the images didn't lie. You know, they didn't have artificial intelligence, and some of them were staged, but a lot of them were just really snapshot style. And between that and the oral archives, there was a lot of good information there, like the University of Alaska Fairbanks Oral History Department. They have a program called Jukebox, where they interviewed a lot of these elders. I don't know how many years they go back, and all these things are on record and can be listened to, and that's a real valuable resource. And these elders are not going to be around there much longer. And if the children, I have seen that in my fieldwork, sometimes I was the outsider, the older person, the non-native person that was interested in their stories and their old-time experiences, and their own grandchildren sadly sometimes weren't. And that is sort of heartbreaking, but it also potentially does really damage to the culture. I mean, as long as the native languages are endangered too now. Inupiaq, fortunately, is still pretty healthy, pretty viable. A lot of kids speak it. It's spoken at home. It's spoken in school. So that will go on for a while, but you cannot underestimate the damage that Western economies Western diseases, and unfortunately also the missionaries did to native cultures, where they banned native dancing and ceremonies. And so some of that stuff is really hardly to retrieve and probably lost forever. And so it's almost a duty to, you know, keep these, as much of this knowledge alive as possible. And as an outsider, at least I am trained as an anthropologist to tell these stories and to vet the sources critically. And yeah, so.
One of the things that I was really fascinated by was at the beginning of the book, there's the two maps. So one of them is the Russian map of Siberia, and the other one is a drawing, the native view of the Bering Strait. And I just thought that that was a really powerful, like, visual depiction of the differences in the way that that place is seen by the people who have lived there for thousands of years versus somebody who came much later. I thought that was a really powerful image comparison.
Well, if you remember, there's actually three of them, and they're sort of the only part of the book that's arranged chronologically. So the first map that I really like is one from the early Russian exploration, where Alaska, the whole state, and Western Alaska in particular, is just a shapeless blob. So that's how it appeared on, you know, Siberia is really detailed and really well done. And then Alaska is just this amorphous mass that they had heard about, and a few people had gone there, but they didn't know what was where or anything, what the geography looked like. And then you have that native map that you alluded to, which chronologically, it was done a little later. It was documented by, I can't remember now the top of my head, but by some white explorer that solicited the map, and it's on a sealskin painted, and it shows this. It's not like a map in the traditional sense, but it shows different activities, subsistence activities. It shows some landscape features. It shows some white whalers and their ships coming. So it's a different concept of mapping a place. And then the ultimate juxtaposition is, of course, that the gold miners' detailed map of Western Alaska, where, okay, they have the military fort at St. Michael is marked, and then the gold-bearing fields, and that was mostly what mattered to people. And I like, in general, I like to juxtapose these. I give the information, what they are and where they're from, but not right. You have to go to the image notes to do that, because I wanted people to look at these images and think about what they're seeing. And the same is true for throughout the book. As you remember, I have one image juxtaposed to the beginning face of each chapter of the book. And I had actually a conversation with Lawrence Millman, who's a fellow writer and Arctic explorer mycologist. And he said, where are the image captions? And I said, you know what? They're in the back. People can't get the information in the back. I do not want any captions. I want people to look at the image and then look at the title of the chapter and see if they can make a connection or if it creates some resonance. I'm a writer. I like to explain a lot of facts and stuff, but I also want to have people do their own thinking a little bit and stimulation when they read or when they look at a book.
I think that's a really powerful way to tell those stories and have that laid out in that manner, which I think that, you know, could be a topic of discussion in and of itself, right? Is how do we, you know, history, how much of history is what we are told that it was versus what, you know, talking to the people who lived it or relying on records of people who lived it versus interpretations later, you know, that being told versus observing it changes the story and the narrative a lot.
It doesn't only pertain to history, though. I talked a little bit about that in Arctic Traverse, where I'm talking about what I used to do sometimes when I took youths out on these educational courses or even with commercial clients on trips. They come to me, they say, what's that flower called, you know? And I say, well, I could tell you that, but then you think you know it and you file it away and you're really not seeing it, you know, or understanding what it does even in the bigger ecological context. So sometimes I used to play a little game with them, say, I know what it's called and I'm going to tell you, but why don't you look at it and tell me what you would call it if you had to come up with a name? And what that does, it forces people to really use their creativity and actually really look at the damn thing, you know? So
yeah.
Maybe that's a sort of the equivalent to what you were talking about.
Yeah, I think that's a great,
it's a fine line as a writer between being a guide where you want to guide the reader, but not, you know, get on your little soapbox and preach to them or explain everything to the T-dot. I personally don't mind if there's something that I didn't explain, and I'm trying not to make it big things, but little, like the other day somebody said, you mentioned manifest destiny and you're not even going into that. Well, for one thing, I assume that everybody with a higher education degree knows about manifest destiny, and then readers who don't, I you know, I do it myself too. If I come across something, I don't know what it is, I go and look it up to the dictionary. Now with electronic format books, you can even click on the word and it takes you right to a dictionary. So let's not be too lazy, folks, right?
You already sort of mentioned that you were not interested in the gold rush history part of Gnome. So I don't necessarily want to dwell on this, but I just think that it's important because Gnome is such a different like physical environment and cultural environment than a lot of like California or like the where the, you know, the Klondike gold rush. How do you think that that physical and cultural environment shaped the gold rush differently in Gnome versus in other places?
First of all, I need to correct you on saying that I'm not interested in the gold rush at all. I am interested. And there is actually the first chapter of the main body of the book, City of Dreams, is about that, because like I said earlier, it was just too crazy. I mean, there were just things that normal people wouldn't understand. You would never think people do, like a guy ferrying somebody's load from ship to shore, and the ferryman was paid in an onion, and vegetables were really, really in short supply that first winter in Gnome. And so he ended up sitting on the beach there and eating it like an apple. I mean, stuff like that. No writer in his right mind can pass up like stuff like that.
Yeah.
As far as comparing the Gnome Rush, it's actually interesting that the Gnome Gold Rush was actually the biggest one on actually American soil. Because if you remember, the Klondike was on Canadian in the Yukon Territory. There were a lot of people coming through Alaska, through Skagway, and through St. Michael, coming up the Yukon River to get there. But the gold rush itself played out on Canadian territory. And then, of course, it shifted when the gold fields were played out or everything was claimed by major corporations or landholders. Then the Gnome thing happened, of course. And then the whole stampede just shifted to the Bering Strait, and including these people that I've dedicated one chapter to, these crazy characters that just got on their bicycle and rode from the Klondike to Gnome on the frozen rivers and so on. What really made the Gnome strike different is do have the hard rock mining where people sank mining shafts and had to thaw permafrost and all that. But there was also a significant amount of mining to be done for the people on the beaches, and they were common property. They would not allow the beaches to be claimed by individuals. And so they called the poor man's diggings, they called them. And anybody could just set their rocker box up there and dig for gold. And these beaches, there's a lot of the gold that was in nugget form in the gravel bars farther inland got in finer form as gold flour and gold dust washed down into and settled on those beaches. And so you could make a fortune there on the beaches too. And that's interestingly also still where today, again, or still the gold mining is going on. A lot of it is offshore where people have these floating pontoon boats and they're sitting out there and they're siphoning up the ocean bottom and they're running it through the filters and whatnot. And of course, that's the subject of a famous reality TV show, I hear. So it was very much more accessible than the Klondike. You had to either go over the Chilkoot Pass, or you had to go this long-ass voyage all the way up the Yukon River, and then chance being frozen in and having to overwinter before you even got to the gold fields. And there were a lot of chichacos that didn't know what they were doing. They got into trouble. Whereas the Gnome Gold Rush, you could take a steamer from San Francisco to Seattle to St. Michael and right to Gnome. You know, they docked, they call it the roadstead, the area right offshore from the city of Gnome. And the ships anchored there. They didn't have a deep water harbor, so they couldn't land. They really had to get people out in freighters. And then also they built this crazy cable car that I have a photo of in the book where the people actually came on land in this, a lot of them, you know, women and such, in these cable car cages. So it was a lot more accessible and, you know, had a different component of people that wouldn't have made it to eventually. The criminals and the shysters and the hucksters, they made it to Dawson too. But in Gnome, there was a lot more of that going on early on.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. I'm talking to author Michael Engelhard about his book, No Place Like Gnome.
Gnome's indigenous community has faced like waves of change, obviously. You know, we talked a little bit about that, you know, Western diseases, relocation, politics of all kinds, just because of you know, other people coming there. How do you think that their story, obviously not speaking for them, but how do you think that their story is best understood? Is it more one of resilience versus like reinvention? So holding fast to those traditions versus adapting and reshaping?
You know, there's that misconception that Native cultures before contact with white people, they lived sort of in an ahistoric limbo where the culture was always same, which is really kind of paternalistic, and cultures always change. It's just the pace that a culture changes that changes. And we're seeing that right now with computer and AI. I mean, we had changed before, but now changes incrementally faster than it used to be. And the same is true for a lot of native cultures. And one of the mark of especially northern native cultures, Arctic native cultures, is an incredible amount of adaptability, you know, to changing resources, to starvations, to there were trading partnerships between inland groups and coastal groups that were not even the same people. You know, the inland groups sometimes were Athabascan Indians, and the coastal groups were Nupiak and Yupik, and sometimes they were fighting each other. They had pitched battles in the Brooks Range, but also at other times, or even at the same time, they had trading partnerships that cut across these boundaries that allowed people not only to trade with each other, but even to move. So when there was a shortage on the coast, you could move inland and live with the family of your trading partner and hunt and use their resources. Or that people that, you know, it's often mentioned the so-called wife swapping, you know, we call it an anthropology spouse exchange, where it was actually an adaptive mechanism that allowed people, the offspring of those relationships, could choose to live with either side of the family, which in times of famine, or just as far as, you know, you don't get along with your family, so you live with, you know, your other family, it allows incredible adaptability. And the same, you can see the same thing with the advent of Westerners in the Seward Peninsula. The big example I'm using, I'm talking in detail about the book, is the reindeer herding, you know, which Sheldon Jackson, the Commissioner of Education for Alaska at the time, and also a missionary, wanted, there were twofold, the agenda was twofold, actually. One part of the agenda was to so-called to civilize these native people, which for Sheldon Jackson meant to make him more sedentary, not have him move him around so much, and then also really become what he considered productive members of a Western economy, which basically is you get reindeer and you breed them and you accumulate capital and then you trade on that capital and you get interest on that capital rather than being dependent on these rather independable, sometimes natural resources. That was the second part of the agenda, was there were really widespread starvation going on, and the reindeer herding was supposed to alleviate that, because not only was it an investment in capital, but also you could kill some of the reindeer and eat them if you were hungry, right? What Jackson didn't mention, of course, I don't know if he even knew, and what other people also don't see, is that part of the reason why there was a widespread famine throughout the Bering Strait at the time that the Westerners came was that the whalers already had hunted not just the whales, but they ended up going after walrus when the whales ran out, and they ended up going after caribou because they had to feed themselves. So that those cycles of starvation already were exacerbated by Western presence. And the reindeer herding, yeah, you know, Native people, herders, they were really able to pick and choose. Like, for example, there was this competition, you could call it, between what makes a better draft animal. Is it a reindeer? Because they harness them, they train them, they harness them for sled. They delivered the mail and goods by that way. But there was also the long standing local tradition of using dog teams, you know. And so people experimented with both. And in the end, I think the people that ended up running the reindeer sleds were mostly the Sami herders, the then, as they called, Laplanders from Norway that had been brought over to teach the Inupiaq how to be herders. And the Inupiaq still stuck with their dogs because they thought they were just more reliable means of transportation. So they were very well able to pick and choose according to the situation, what they wanted to adopt and what they didn't. Of course, that wasn't always, you know, that wasn't always the case. They did not have a say in, you know, whether they even wanted reindeer where they used to have caribou or not. But once the caribou, the reindeer were there, they tried to make the best out of it.
I want to kind of circle back to that, to some of what you just touched on, but first, to kind of connect it all together, one of the themes that really stood out to me was this, how survival knowledge kind of evolves into an industry. You talk about like clothing and how that was obviously first and foremost a survival, you know, in the Arctic, that was first and foremost a survival perfected by, you know, thousands of years of indigenous knowledge. Today's outdoor clothing industry sells, you know, high-tech versions of the same idea. Do you see any clear lineage there? Do you think the outdoor clothing industry recognizes or even acknowledges where that came from originally?
So first of all, what I see there is an interesting give and take. So it wasn't just, you see with the example of outdoors clothing, skin sewing, you see that it wasn't just a one-way exchange. It wasn't just the Inupiat that adopted Western traditions, but here you get these explorers, not all of them, some of them still preferred leather boots and canvas backpacks, but the smart ones at least, they realized that this gear was really unequaled for northern exploration. And Nome skin sewers, they ended up forming their own corporation and supplying sleeping bags and mukluks and mittens for the army during the war. And also explorers like Roald Amundsen really were smart and said, well, this works here, this works in the Antarctic, you know, and had custom items made for them. And interestingly, I'm not sure that the modern outdoor industry actually acknowledges what they owe to native, especially insulative clothing, you know. Rain gear, they made rain gear from walrus gut. They made parkas that kayakers wore like your modern spray jacket. You could even cinch them around the combing of your kayak and do an Eskimo roll and stay totally dry, you know. And the natural properties of some of the materials that the native seamstresses use is exactly what you get now from synthetics. So the caribou hair, for example, which was a major component in the insulative powers of a lot of these items of gear, is the same as a holofill, because it's a hollow hair which adds an air layer inside, or it traps an air layer inside the caribou hair, which not only helps the caribou to swim better, but it also, of course, insulates the animal against the cold. And same with muskox, the kiviat, you know, the underwool of muskoxen is 7 times warmer than sheep wool. And I don't know how it compares to synthetic fiber per weight, per, you know, ounce or quantity, but it's really hard to imagine that there's anything warmer. And I think it's telling that the mushers, the Iditarod mushers and other outdoors people, they may use all kinds of fancy gear, but oftentimes the footwear and the headgear, the hats, the mukluks, and the mittens are still seal skin or caribou skin or even polar bear skin, wolf skin. The parka ruff, you know, the hood of a parka is a total Inupiaq or Eskimo design, you know, with a big, sometimes using two different kinds of fur that wolverine was really popular. And I've read studies, test studies, where why does wolverine hair not accumulate frost like other furs do? And they still haven't really nailed that down. They think it might have something to do with the length of the hair or with the pliability that it shakes the frost off. But that stuff, I don't think that has all been really acknowledged by the outdoor gear industry or even replicated in synthetic materials.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with you. What, when survival knowledge becomes a global industry or becomes any sort of industry, how does that change its knowledge or change its meaning? You know, does it risk becoming exploitation of a culture and their knowledge, or can it sort of be both?
I think as long as the source, the origin is acknowledged, I think there's nothing wrong with it. Like I said, we all have always, human societies from the beginning of time have borrowed from each other. And now with where big money's to be made, I think it's a matter of decency to honor who you took the idea from, and not just honor, but also if possible to cut them in on the, you know, I don't know how feasible that is. Economy is obviously not my strong suit, but I think it's really crucial to pay people's dues where the dues are due. Well, that's a strange sentence. Anyway, the thing about the survival knowledge is that it's not just one body of lore that you gain and you have, especially now with the climate spiraling out of control. Even a lot of the traditional survival knowledge is just not applicable anymore. Native people die out there on the sea ice, going through sea ice with their snow machines when they're out traveling. And that is really unprecedented, where even the elders, it gets to a point where the elders' knowledge becomes almost like obsolete. And a new body of survival knowledge with different technology. You know, we have GPS now and all that. And sometimes these work in combination, like up in Barrow, at Utqiagvik, where they go whaling. They now use high-tech geophysical instruments to measure the thickness of the ice, but they're still consulting with the elders there because, you know, you just can't beat that kind of knowledge that has been honed down and proven over generations.
I think one of the things that is interesting about, like, you know, the advent of technology and using those tools versus, you know, the knowledge inherent within a culture or a people. And you sort of mentioned this when you were talking about guiding, is I think we sort of lose our powers of observation, right? We rely so much on the technology and the tools that we're not then also observing how accurate those are, or how, you know, how to sort of make our own decisions while also incorporating the knowledge from the technology. I think of that with like GPS, right? Driving, you know, people stop paying attention to where they're going because they're relying on the GPS versus trying to figure out how to get somewhere.
I think what we need to keep in mind is this idea of technology, what it really means. You got to sit down and take a break and think about it. And you and I, when we say technology, we imply that it's a certain kind of technology. We're talking about mostly digital computers and so on. But the matter of fact is that the technology starts with an arrowhead or with a sewing needle. And so I've been often accused of being anti-technology. I'm not. I just want a technology that's humane, that's not destructive to the environment, and that doesn't alienate you from what's surrounding you. You know, like, for example, on the Brooks Range Traverse, I did not take a camera for various reasons. I said, for one thing, it's sort of like a filter between me and what's out there. And I used to know a guy who's a professional landscape photographer, and he says, when I'm out there, even when I don't carry the camera, I just see the landscape in little frames, you know? And I didn't want to do that. And of course, it bit me in the behind afterwards when I was trying to, have press releases and such. I didn't have any. Or when I do events, you know, people expect images these days. You can't just stand in front of a crowd and hardly read or talk anymore. So I ended up having to borrow video footage from a guy who's a former fire jumper in Fairbanks, who'd also done the traverse and had fortunately brought a video camera and film. So when I do presentations, I use clips from him. But above all, I still do not regret not having brought a camera, because that made a whole different kind of experience. I did have to, you got to decide on a case-by-case basis. I did bring a satellite phone because being so low, it would really have been foolish and too much of a risk not to have any kind of communication where I couldn't call a plane or, some rescue attempt in if something happened to me. Also, of course, I was told by my wife I needed to have to bring one. Otherwise, I would not get permission to go.
Yeah. I think one of the problems, too, with especially a place like the Arctic, and that's probably one of the places that I've experienced this, that I can definitely remember experiencing this, is that it is so, even if you do have a camera or, you know, something to capture it, it's so vast and just spectacular that it's impossible to do any sort of justice to the place with a single image or even a video or even a combination of images, right? It's very hard to capture that same feeling of the place.
Absolutely, Martha. As a writer, I couldn't agree more. And I always say, the saying is, a picture says more than 1,000 words. I say, well, then your 1,000 words are not really well chosen. And if I, as a writer, cannot paint a picture and more with my words, then I should hang up my profession and do something else. And I mean, look at it with a camera, even when you have a video camera, let's say, you know, you can record the sounds and you can record the images. But as a writer, I have so much more. I have tactile sensations that I can fill in. I have smells I can talk about, my whole emotional inner state. That stuff like that is really hard to get across with visual means only.
Yeah, agreed. Kind of pivoting on, keeping in the vein of photographs, you talk about photographs and the way that those shaped the outsider's view of Nome and the Arctic, and that they were often sort of staged or idealized. Do you see any parallels between that early outsider gaze and kind of how social media and the internet now influence the way remote places are perceived and consumed by people who may never set foot there?
That's actually an interesting comparison. I never even thought about that, but there seems to be something, intuitively, I feel there seems to be something to it, because both, modern social media, especially visually oriented platforms, and these celebrity photographers, the Lomans, for example, in Nome, they run the big reindeer operation and also meatpacking and have their hands in all kinds of business. They also ran a photo studio, and they did a lot of these photos, and they're excellent. They're really great portraits, sort of in the style of Edward Sheriff Curtis, some of them, and others are really great snapshots that you can use for ethnographic information, or even the people if they want to learn about their own culture. But they also sold them as souvenirs, postcards, including some that you would not find acceptable anymore, with, you know, bare-breasted women feeding their children and such, that were clearly exploitative, where the people that got photographed, if they even were asked for their permission, never saw a cent of that, what the Lomans were making of that. But both, and the souvenir market was booming, really. Even during the gold rush already, there were ivory covers, native walrus ivory covers that copied ads from Western papers and sold those ivory replicas of these ads, these illustrations from newspapers to the miners and others that stopped by in Nome. And the same with photos. A lot of the photos that the Lohman brothers did at the time, they ended up circulating as postcards. So there's definitely that connection between that and modern visual platforms. And both, to me, at least the more superficial kind of photography with the posed portraits, are very pretty, but it also it glosses over some of the problems that culture contact created and some of the real life situations that people experienced. And it never gets below the surface, really. It's a glossy surface, you know. Unfortunately, I don't think that a lot of that early photography actually brought people to Nome. It was the gold and other economic opportunities, but it oftentimes it reinforced these stereotypes. You know, if you see a camp to Western eyes on the beach might look messy, but you have to understand the culture that said, okay, this is hunter-gatherers. They live differently. They organize their lives differently. And also they were already affected by the white man's problems at that point. So you're not actually seeing images of the traditional culture, but you're already seeing images of the culture, how it has been affected.
Sort of taking that also to landscapes, you know, we see a lot of people flocking. The one that sticks out to me is there's a place in Iceland that somebody took a photo of, and it was so popular that everybody, now all of these social media influencers want to go to Iceland to get this one shot. And it's really kind of worn down the landscape to get and is kind of dangerous to go get this photograph that everybody wants to get. So, you know, people flock to these fragile landscapes to get the shot, putting themselves at risk, damaging the environment. Do you think that this desire for the perfect image, kind of whether it was 100 years ago or now, changes the way that we value these places or contributes to their exploitation?
I think they make them actually exchangeable because we're so inundated with so many similar looking images that it sort of like takes the specialness of a place away. And fortunately, the area in the Bering Strait, it doesn't have these photographic, absolute stunning vistas or landmarks that people flock to. So I don't think that'll ever be an issue there. The Arctic is a very subtle landscape oftentimes. Even the Brooks Range, you know, you compare it to the Alaska Range, people would say, it's nothing. But to me, that makes it special because, for one thing, I can pick a place in the landscape and travel there without any kind of technological, you know, I don't need a rope, I don't need crampons, I don't need a helicopter. And it's a more human, you know, forbidding. Large parts of our national parks in Alaska are just glaciers, just ice, you know, like the Wrangell St. Elias, nothing lives there. I mean, it's a dead place. It's beautiful in the abstract, and it's beautiful to the few who can afford to go there. But to the rest of them, it's just another shot with glaciers. You know, I've heard comments like when I'm traveling at Bryce Canyon in Utah National Park, or even the South Rim of the Grand Canyon, where sometimes I just eavesdrop. I could write a whole book about just the kind of scene that's going on up there. But what strikes me, you know, I hear families saying when they get out of the car, they spend 5 minutes at the viewpoint, and they're saying, well, do we have to go to this other one too, or can we go back to the lodge? You know, where viewpoint after viewpoint, the experience is similar. And yet, to me, people never get a deep experience of the canyon because they haven't hiked down and they haven't spent time in the canyon backcountry and they haven't gone down on a raft on the river. So there's all these perspectives they're missing out on. And I see the same with, it's just, a lot of it is just status oriented now, you know. It's not even about the beauty or what the place means or the story that connects to them, but I've been there, I have affordable income, I'm part of the in crowd, I know where this is, and, you know, I get likes, basically. So here you hear the anti-technology Michael Engelhardt speaking.
I think, I think one of the things about the Arctic, especially like the Brooks Range, is how many people get to go there, right? How many people get to actually experience that? And I actually think that it's probably one of the most special landscapes and special areas in the entire world. And, you know, what a handful of people in the history of this country really will ever get to see or experience that. And for me, it's like the feeling that you get when you're there is very different than it is pretty much anywhere else I've ever been.
It still is there, but also I have to tell you, it's changed quite a bit. I have noticed that it's gotten noticeably busier, especially when you're out of places like Anaktuvuk Pass, mm-hmm. which is at the heart of Gates of the Arctic National Park, and you can't get a commercial flight there, which is a real big attractive thing for some travelers because you don't have to charter a plane to get into the backcountry. You can fly in commercially for a few hundred bucks, and you can hiking right. You can start hiking right in the village, and be out there in really wild lands within a week or so. You know, and so I attribute this to COVID, because you know people have after COVID during COVID they learn to more explore their own backyards. You know, drawing in nature and that kind of thing, nature photography, the super blooms, all that stuff where people couldn't travel internationally. And so they focus, which per se is really actually a good thing. You know, why travel to Hawaii if we got this incredible, and I do too, don't get me wrong, but, you know, if we have this incredible landscape just in our backyard. But it also, I've seen groups there that are really large of people that don't know what they're doing. And unfortunately, even by people like, they were promoted by people like me, like a guy that wrote the light, ultralight backpacking Bible, so to speak, gear Bible, is now teaching, they call them instruction courses up there. But what it basically is, they're taking large groups of totally inexperienced people out there and calling him, you know, you actually need to apply. It's not just where you plop down money and you get a place guaranteed, but you have to apply and be approved. But to me, it's just commercial guiding under a different guise. And, you know, I've seen groups up there outside of Anaktuvu Pass of 10 or 12 people. And that's just, I've never seen that in decades that I've been guiding up there or traveling up there. And to me, the numbers thing, for one thing, traveling in a group this large, I think you actually lose out. You start to lose out. I like solo travel. I don't mind going with people. I prefer to keep my groups small, because I noticed from long experience that when you get larger groups of people, not only are you much slower in the morning to break camp and get going, but also you get cliques and you get this whole different social dynamic where, you know, people play when the hiking gets boring, instead of looking for something to focus their attention on, they live in their heads. They talk about sports and movies and stuff. So not to mention the impact actually on the land, you know, a campsite that gets impacted by 12 people will overnight look a lot different than a campsite that has two or three people camping there.
Yeah, I think it's definitely sort of a double-edged sword, right? Like, we want people to be aware of these things, the importance of the land, the significance of the land, but like minimizing the impact on our impact on it is also important. And also some people who experience that landscape will then go on to feel very strongly about conserving it, whereas people who have never been there maybe don't care as much. So it's sort of a really interesting balance, I think.
And I've struggled with that as a writer and as a guide for decades, because as a guide, you know, I used to bring people out there, show with the agenda to educate, to have them, show them a good time. But also, you know, I'm part of the industry. And as a writer, too, I write about these places. I wonder how many people now will travel to Nome. I hope some, at least, because it's a really cool place. And it's not, you know, they're not going to ruin anything there. And they're not going to come in such numbers. But there's always that people should hear about these places, but they should also hear that we need to take care of them. And I still don't know to this point quite how to resolve that contradiction. Same with, you know, the fossil fuel industry. I rant and rage about what's going on, drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And yet I've been the one who has gotten on planes and taken people up there. And it's just, it shows me how deeply we are entrenched in this system, how hard it is to step outside, you know, and how do you do that responsibly? And how do you do that without causing more harm than good? You know, that is to me the big, and we need to be aware of these contradictions and try to give back something in some form. And that's basically what I've been trying to do for many years.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that there are people there out there trying to, you know, resolve or bring awareness to the contradiction and the importance of acknowledging that. I think that's important. Circling back to Nome quickly to kind of wrap things up. Nome has always been a crossroads, and as we've also talked about, you know, the rest of the Arctic, climate change is changing its story a lot. When readers finish No Place Like Nome, what do you hope that they carry with them about Nome's past, its present, or its future?
Well, one thing I want them to know that Nome, for a lot of outsiders or even Americans or even Alaskans, Nome is sort of like a backwater. And that is sort of like ethnocentric, you know, back to us, Alaska, if you're in New York, Alaska is a backwater, right? If you live in Fairbanks or Anchorage, then Nome is a backwater. To the Inupiaq who live out there, it's the center of the world. So this is kind of like, you know, there's no boundaries. There's no here or there. There's just wherever you are, that's important to you. And that's a big thing I want readers to take away from it, and then also just the cultural diversity and the role that this podunk town in the middle of nowhere, for most people when they first see it, the role that that has played, and interestingly, might also play again. They're building a deep water harbor now, and the Northwest Passage is ice-free, and as is the Northeast Passage, so there will be circumarctic travel now, including commercial travel for resources and also tourism. There's the first in Nome, they're already docking from European cruise ships, you know, and the Coast Guard will have to have a presence too now with that things with Russia are heating up again. Honestly, for the sales of the book, I'm hoping that things come to a head, that people want to learn about Nome,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think it does a great job of giving a picture into who you are too, you know, in addition to telling the story of Nome.
That's the thing. That's another reason why I didn't want to quite write a chronological book, because I wanted a little bit of me in there, you know, not as much as I normally have. It was interesting. David James, who reviewed the book in the Anchorage Daily News, actually said, you know, that was your first book that's mostly focused on people, not on nature. And I realized, yeah, I knew it was the first book that has an urban sort of setting, but I wasn't aware that it's so much about people, because I always try to include people in their stories in my writing. And the most important thing, how do people relate to the land? How do they utilize the land? How do they respect the land? And what does living in a certain place does to the people, to the minds, and to the way they grow up and are being shaped by the land? So that dynamic is always somewhere at the bottom of my writing. And I want people to be aware that Nome might look like a city and people ride around in trucks, but you know, there's stuff under the surface where people believe there's eight-legged polar bears out there and such. You know, don't judge that image by the way it looks. And again, that's where it comes in, that the visuals are important, but you gotta go to an Eskimo drum dance and listen and talk to people, or go to a potluck at the church or at the community center. That is the real Nome. You don't get the real Nome, you know, when you go there for the Iditarod and you wait at the finish line.
That's all for today's show. Thank you to my guest, Michael Engelhard. You can find more information about our guests and this show on the Outdoor Explorer page at alaskapublic.org. Thank you to our producer, Tobin Shelby, and to Ammon Swenson for his additional support. And from all the hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thank you for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.